DW Inside Europe.
Hello, I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. On today's programme, a damning report says the German military lacks equipment and recruits. 500 years since the death of Leonardo da Vinci, we take a closer look at some of his work.
Di Pietro pulls out another Leonardo treasure, a leather-bound notebook. It's crammed with his famed right-to-left writing that needs to be read with a mirror and sketches of his inventions.
C'è qua. Ed è un pipistrello.
Also on the show, Scandal in Scotland. We have the latest for you on Scotland's former First Minister, Alex Salmond. He's been charged with attempted rape and sexual offences. These stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. Last Thursday, January 24th, police in Scotland arrested Alex Salmond, the former Scottish First Minister, on multiple charges, including rape and sexual assault. Salmond has been a prominent figure in Scottish and indeed UK politics since the late 80s, and his arrest is seen as a scandal on an unprecedented scale. Jack Foster has the latest from Edinburgh.
For me as leader, my time is nearly over. But for Scotland, the campaign continues, and the dream shall never die.
Alex Salmond speaking on the morning of September 19th, 2014, announcing his resignation as First Minister of Scotland following defeat in the first independence referendum since the country became a part of the United Kingdom over 300 years earlier. For many, Alex Salmond wasn't only the figurehead but the driving force of Scotland's 2014 independence campaign. Having spent 20 years as the leader of the Scottish National Party, he's undoubtedly become one of the most influential figures, not just in Scottish, but UK politics as a whole. Given that, the news of his arrest last week, charged with multiple counts of sexual assault, has rocked Scottish politics to its core. The 64-year-old former First Minister of Scotland appeared at Edinburgh Sheriff Court last Thursday, where he was charged with 14 offences, 9 charges of sexual assault, 2 of attempted rape, 2 of indecent assault, and 1 breach of the peace. Mr. Salmond spoke to members of the press outside of the court, where he maintained his position that he is innocent on all charges.
So let me say at the outset, I am innocent of any criminality whatsoever. As you'll remember, in the long process of judicial review, I made it clear in order to respect the court that I would make no comment until proceedings had concluded. That I did in the statement I made in the steps of the court of session 2 weeks ago. Now that these proceedings, criminal proceedings, are live, it is even more important to respect the court. And therefore, the only thing I can say is I refute absolutely these allegations of criminality, and I'll defend myself to the utmost in court.
Many commentators are now wondering whether the arrest of the former First Minister and undoubtedly the SNP's most well-known face could have a negative fallout for the drive for independence. Alex Salmond's successor, First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, claims that's not the case, that the independence movement is, quote, bigger than any one man, and insists she'll be setting out plans for a second independence referendum in the coming weeks. Stuart Stevenson is a member of the Scottish Parliament for the SNP and is a former government minister who served under Alex Salmond, and he joins me on the line now. Mr. Stevenson, how concerned are you, regardless of what the eventual outcome might be, that a scandal of this magnitude might cast a shadow over the SNP politically?
The party is, of course, substantially bigger than a single individual, although that individual, of course, was very much central to the party's success over recent years. And the evidence I have from talking to members of the party and meeting members of the public does not immediately suggest there's a dramatic problem, because people know that the central purpose of the SNP is independence for Scotland, and that is much more what people will decide their political affiliation on than anything that pertains to a single individual. The party is bigger than one person.
There was a fairly lukewarm response from the SNP when he launched his chat show on Russia Today, and then he actually left the party in August last year during his judicial review against the Scottish Government over handling of sexual misconduct charges. More recently, he's criticised the party after its website now has no mention of his name in its history section. Is it safe to say that the SNP is doing all it can to distance itself from Alex Salmond?
I don't think that's really an issue, because in the public mind, Alex Salmond has been part of the SNP's success and deserves enormous credit for the contribution that he's made to the cause of independence. But the matters that you've just talked about, for example, his leaving the party, his taking a show on Russia Today, show that issues that might be have been thought would create a difficulty for the SNP have in effect been invisible in their effect. So therefore, I think that shows that we have a party that's united around its aim of achieving independence for Scotland, that we have a population in Scotland who understand what that proposition means, and it's not about a single individual. It's not even about a single political party. It's about the overarching requirement for us to take powers into our hands in Scotland and do things much better than we're seeing is happening at Westminster. And I think the travails of individuals and the actions of individuals are significantly trumped, if I can use that word, by the overarching idea of Scottish independence.
Stuart Stevenson there, SNP member of the Scottish Parliament and a former minister in the Scottish Government under Alex Salmond. Of course, not everyone shares Stuart Stevenson's optimism, and one man who does think that these events are already creating a division within the SNP is the party's former deputy leader, Jim Sillars. Once a close ally of Alex Salmond, Sillars broke away from the party leadership in the early 90s.
This is a result of the party allowing the cult of personality to develop around Alex Salmond, then allowed it to develop around the personality of Nicola Sturgeon. So this isn't a divide on policy, this is a divide on personalities. And over the time of the development of the cult of the personalities, the SNP as a party has been hollowed out intellectually. And so it really is not in a very good position to manage this particular crisis.
Former deputy leader of the Scottish National Party, Jim Sillars. Strict reporting laws in Scotland mean that once a criminal case becomes live, journalists and indeed members of the public using social media are heavily restricted in what they can and can't say. Only the name of the accused and the charges levelled against them are permitted. Any further detail about the background to a case is not allowed in case it prejudices the outcome. Given that, there is a surreal quiet in political and journalistic circles around this undoubtedly huge case here in Scotland. And that's likely to last for some time, as no date has been fixed for the trial yet. Alex Salmond's legal team will obviously be working to avoid the case going to court, but in the event that it does, it will likely be before a jury at the High Court, and it could be at least a year from now before that begins. Jack Foster, DW, Edinburgh.
From Bonn, Germany, you're listening to Inside Europe.
A damning report says the German military lacks equipment and recruits. To discuss, DW's security correspondent Thomas Sparrow is on the line. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, Keith. Nice to be with you.
Welcome back to Inside Europe. Tell us more.
Well, this is a parliamentary Bundeswehr report. It's a regular report presented by the Bundestag military commissioner, who is now called Hans-Peter Bartels. And obviously his goal is to try and find precisely where there are problems within the German military. We can summarize those problems as it has already been summarized, saying that the German military is under-equipped, understaffed, and overly bureaucratic. This is certainly not good news for a German military that has been trying in the last few years to play a more important role internationally, embedded in sort of bigger missions within NATO, for example, or UN missions in different parts of the world. It's also important to stress this is not necessarily new. It's not the first time that we hear that the German military has very serious problems. In fact, that's a big topic here in Germany, and it's always a topic when these reports come out. But the fact that now this report also came out stressing all these issues just makes that debate more important in Germany as Germany tries to play a more important role internationally.
And how do these issues affect day-to-day operations?
According to the report, they do affect day-to-day operations when soldiers, for example, have to rely on civilian helicopters if they want to be moved from one part to the next, or vital equipment that they have to borrow. And again, this is not new. We've heard previously reports of equipment that the military has that are either outdated or not fully operational, that they can't use at any given time, that they're struggling to fill key positions, that the maintenance is also affected, that training programs are suffering. So you can see that there are lots of issues. There's a wide range of issues here that have been stressed on various occasions to mention precisely that the German military is having serious problems.
And we've spoken about this before with you, Thomas, but why is it still happening?
Well, specifically, the commissioner mentioned that it's not because of money. In fact, the budget rose, so the military does have more money to buy equipment or to improve all these issues that we've been talking about. It is saying that it is because of bureaucracy, because there are all sorts of big problems that are not being handled properly. And he specifically, as I said, mentioned the issue of the Bundeswehr being too bureaucratic, overly bureaucratic, and those are issues that he suggested in this particular case should be dealt with. It's also important to stress, Keith, that this is not something that is just happening now or in the last few years. The Bundeswehr has had problems for a very long time that has to do with the changing role of Germany internationally. For example, well, after reunification, military investment decreased, and back then the military was only capable of certain deployments. But then, for example, after the Crimea annexation a few years ago, then Germany understood that it also had to increase its role internationally in a military way, and that came hand in hand with proposals from the government to increase the budget to try and improve all these problems. And that's why German Defence Minister von der Leyen has said that it's important to look at the long view when it comes to this, and that the Bundeswehr, yes, it might have many problems, but according to her, it is going in the right direction.
And as part of that long-term vision, as far as German Chancellor Angela Merkel is concerned, I mean, part of her vision is a single European army for the future of the EU. I mean, what's that going to look like, given the issues that the Bundeswehr are having?
Well, obviously, this is an issue that for German Chancellor Angela Merkel and for the government is particularly important, that idea of a common European army, of common European goals when it comes to military terms. We spoke about that, in fact, last week when we were talking about this German-French renewed alliance. But it does raise questions as to how Germany will plan to do all this, will plan to move forward with all these projects that it has, not only this European army, but again, all these missions abroad, when if you look inside the German military, you see all these problems that are being presented by the Bundestag military commissioner Bartels. So it does raise questions, and it does put pressure on the government to try and explain how all these things work together.
Mm-hmm. And very quickly, what else is in this damning report?
There are also two issues that have been discussed as a result of the report, namely, for example, the number of reports of sexual harassment. That was something else that was stressed. The commissioner said that there was now more awareness of this issue, as well of some very important cases that have been discussed. And another issue that, again, is a long-term issue, it's something that's been discussed a lot in recent times, is the possibility of far-right networks within the military. The commissioner said that that was a bit not in his remit, that was beyond his remit, but he did stress that the Bundeswehr is being alert and consistent, and it is dealing with this issue. The opposition, on the other hand, has criticized that very often, and it did so again now by saying that they're presenting it as a series of isolated cases, they're downplaying the issue, and they should deal with that in a much better way.
Thomas Sparrow, DW's security correspondent, thank you very much for your expertise.
My pleasure, Keith.
You're listening to Inside Europe. A 2012 law in the Czech Republic allowing religious orders to recover assets seized by the communists after 1948 was widely seen as a major step towards reconciliation between church and state. However, Parliament has now passed a bill proposed by the present-day Communist Party that would tax any financial compensation, and that is causing widespread anger. Rob Cameron has more from Prague.
A report on Czech television's main evening news after the lower house passed a new bill that would tax the financial compensation due to 16 churches and the Federation of Czech Jewish Communities for assets seized by the communists. In the early years of the regime, members of the Catholic Church and others suffered severe persecution. Priests were imprisoned, tortured, and in some cases killed, and almost all religious property was confiscated. Since the 2012 legislation, the state has been returning churches, land, and works of art valued at 2.9 billion euros. But much of what was seized after 1948, when the communists came to power, can no longer be returned. Those assets were valued in 2012 at 2.3 billion euros, a sum which will be paid out to the religious organizations annually over the next 30 years. Now it seems those payments will be subject to a 19% income tax if, as is likely, this new bill becomes law. It's the brainchild of Stanislav Grospič, an MP for the present-day Communist Party, and he told me why he'd introduced it.
We are merely pointing out that when this land was valued and the compensation determined, they used the price of 1.7 euros per square meter of agricultural land and 1 euro per square meter of forested land. But in reality, when dealing with cases of restitution, the Czech Statistics Office set this price for both agricultural and forested land at 29 euro cents per square meter. So it was considerably overvalued. This law won't be retroactive. It will only affect compensation paid after it comes into effect. So what's been paid out already won't be affected. But even if it comes into effect on January 1st, 2020, we reckon the inflation alone since 2012 will have amounted to around 425 million euros. So the church will still get the same amount, 2.3 billion. They'll just lose what they would have gained in inflation.
Stanislav Grospič stressed to me that he and his colleagues had no wish to punish the church. They were merely correcting a miscalculation to make it fair. That's met with a snort of derision when you speak to those on the other side of the political divide. Marian Jurečka is the deputy chairman of the Christian Democrats. He had this to say when we met shortly afterwards in the parliament canteen.
I think it's just pure politics. All they want to do is demonstrate to their voters, who have long been hostile to the church and religious bodies, that they're capable of punishing the church and weakening church organizations in the Czech Republic. It's quite absurd. And in the case of the Jewish community, they've been robbed three times, first by the Nazis, then by the communists, and now by the governing coalition. So I think in historical terms, it's an absolutely absurd turn of events.
Certainly the communists who prop up Prime Minister Andrei Babiš's minority coalition government threatened to bring it down if the question of taxing church restitution was not addressed. A spokeswoman for the Czech Bishops' Conference told me the bill went against the rule of law and represented a new form of confiscation. They and other religious organizations are now threatening to take the matter all the way to the Constitutional Court. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. Coming up 500 years since the death of Leonardo da Vinci, we take a closer look at some of his work. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. Years ago, this year, one of the world's most brilliant artist, inventor, scientist, and engineer died. Leonardo da Vinci, the famed Renaissance polymath. And in Italy, the birthplace of Leonardo, preparations are underway for a number of exhibitions to celebrate his genius, including one of his famed sketches and notebooks in the northern city of Turin. But before they go on display, they've spent months in Rome at a unique clinic for ancient books and artwork. Megan Williams has this report from Rome.
Che hanno fatto sono comunque in discrete condizioni.
Anna Di Pietro stands in a lab coat and in white gloved hands gingerly holds up a self-portrait drawn by Leonardo da Vinci more than 500 years ago. Of the 13 da Vinci drawings carefully stacked on the table in front of her, she says the self-portrait is in the worst shape. Not due to half a millennia of rips or tears, but the result of chemical damage from shoddy conservation techniques. Di Pietro is one of a dozen or so experts who restore everything from ancient manuscripts to priceless masterpieces here in Rome at the Antique Paper and Parchment Restoration Lab, or its shorthand name, La Patologia del Libro, the Book Pathology Center. It's a small hospital-like building tucked behind a museum on a shady side street. Founded in 1938, it's the oldest institute in the world that repairs ancient books. The restorers are experts in everything that can affect paper: fungus, insects, bacteria. They do DNA analysis and study the metallic traces of instruments used on paper. One discovery they've just made is that Da Vinci used a copper-tipped stylus to draw his portrait of a girl, renowned among art experts as one of the most beautiful drawings in the world. Experts used to think he drew with a silver or gold-tipped stylus. Di Pietro pulls out another Leonardo treasure, a leather-bound notebook. It's crammed with his famed right-to-left writing that needs to be read with a mirror, and sketches of his inventions.
C'è qua. Ed è un pipistrello.
On one page are priceless diagrams of bats and air currents, part of his quest to build a flying machine. On another page, a shopping list with the price of chicken and bran. Even geniuses have to eat.
Enorme valore, proprio.
Nearby, 29-year-old restorer Marta Silvia Filippini sits at a microscope and studies another priceless artifact, a richly and elaborately decorated Ashkenazi Jewish text that dates back to March 1349.
Quindi prelevo il consolidante e applico goccia a goccia.
She applies a special non-toxic Japanese glue to the ink and pigment that had detached from the page.
Maybe today is strange to think, but for centuries, all the history, all the documents of all our cultures are written in paper and parchment. So if we do not conserve these materials, we will lose every witness of our history.
Filippini has worked on everything from ancient Armenian Bibles to hundreds of moldy banknotes recovered from a sunken cruise ship. She says, in a world of digitalized records, it's easy to believe that preservation of paper no longer matters. But she says, with technologies evolving so fast, the cost of transferring pictures to new formats is costly and time-consuming. It can be cheaper and more effective to preserve the original.
Today, a lot of energies are concentrated in digitization, but digitization doesn't conserve something forever. In fact, it's much more difficult to conserve a digitized item. We still have 5 centuries books. We will not have 5 centuries digitized pictures of books.
But if properly restored and conserved, these paper treasures can live for hundreds of more years. Megan Williams, DW, Rome.
If you'd like to contact the show, we would love to hear from you. Here's our email address, europe@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. Coming up in the next half an hour, a disagreement escalates between Athens and the British Museum over the Parthenon marbles, also known as the Elgin marbles. The UK tries a new approach to get children interested in ballet.
Hello there. I hope you're all sitting comfortably in the cinema. My name is Anita. And before we all get to watch the wonderful ballet, I thought it might be nice if I told you a little story.
You're going to love that one. Also coming up, a Dutch Protestant church ends a non-stop service that started in October. Yes, it's all to protect a family of failed asylum seekers from deportation and the benefits of insects as food. Yeah, seriously, it's going to make you hungry. All those stories coming up on Inside Europe.
From Bonn, Germany, you're listening to Inside Europe.
The Greeks have been trying to recover sculptures dating back 2,500 years from the British Museum in London. The Parthenon marbles, also known as the Elgin marbles, were removed from Greece in the 1800s, something the museum dubs a creative act. However, many people consider the artefacts as stolen or looted and want them returned to Athens, their place of origin. But in recent days, the spat has taken on a new twist, with the government in Athens blasting the British Museum for refusing to even consider loaning the masterpieces to Greece. Anthi Karasava reports on the heated Greek reaction and the world's most defiant cultural dispute.
In a tersely worded statement, Greece's culture ministry said the British Museum's outright and final refusal to return the Parthenon marbles to their Greek birthplace was unacceptable. Yet in an unusual move, the government in Athens has gone a bit further, with the culture minister taking a personal jab at the museum's director. The minister has called Hartwig Fischer a cynic, accusing him of using old British colonial arguments to justify his new iron fist stance. Some officials I spoke to this week went even further and likened him to a Nazi supporter. Fischer is German, and he was appointed in recent years to the helm of Britain's most revered museum after directing one of Germany's great cultural entities, the Dresden State Museum. He has launched a radical revamping campaign for some of the most tired and neglected areas of the British Museum, and his appointment ushers what trustees say is a new pragmatism. That's diplomatic shorthand for not being coy or neutral about the British Museum's refusal to hand over the Greek marbles, even in the form of a loan. Athens is fuming, saying Fischer, a 56-year-old polyglot, has purposely chosen to completely disregard landmark decisions taken by world bodies on the preservation of cultural heritage. Athens' reaction is the strongest yet, since Greece vowed a decade ago to take Britain to court over the issue. But for any close watcher of this country like myself, this reaction is far more potent than any other we've seen in recent years. Why? Because nationalist and patriotic sentiments are flaring here. Greeks only recently lost to Macedonia what they consider to be their exclusive right to an ancient Greek name and what it stands for. And after 8 years of painful austerity that has left most Greeks bankrupt, without jobs, and without a future, people here are clinging on to their final, most precious possession, their illustrious past. Sorry, but tough luck. The British Museum says it claims the marble masterpieces that once adorned the Parthenon Temple were bought centuries ago from Lord Elgin, a British aristocrat who sawed them off the ancient temple, saying he was authorized to do so by the Ottomans who then ruled Greece. Umpteen negotiations have since then failed to solve what's being called the world's most complex and longest-running cultural dispute. But throughout the years, public opinion in the UK has shifted in favour of the return of the so-called Elgin marbles. Officials in Athens tell me one of the most promising compromises considered by both sides has been a long-term loan. Under that arrangement, the British Museum would return the more than 130 marble statues, and in exchange, Athens would forfeit its ownership claims, adding a subtle notice to the display denoting the British Museum as the collection's rightful owner. But now that Fischer has pulled the plug on that plan entirely, Greece may have no other option than to resort to legal action. Until then, Fischer and the British Museum insist the Elgin Marbles will stay put in England, encouraging the world to go to London to enjoy them instead. Anthika Sava, DW, Athens.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe. In December, Inside Europe reported on a church in the Netherlands that was trying to prevent the deportation of an Armenian family that was denied asylum. DW correspondent Stefan Boss has been following this story and joins me now for the latest. And it's good news for that family.
Absolutely, and for hundreds of other families as well.
Okay, now first I just want to recap. The parents and their three children had fled Armenia after receiving death threats because of the father's political activism. The Protestant Bethel Church in The Hague used a Dutch law that dates back to the Middle Ages. Theo Hetema is chairman of the Dutch General Council of the Protestant Church.
We hold here a voortdurende kerkdienst, 24 uur per dag.
We're holding a continuous church service, 24 hours each day. We're doing that to provide a place of safety for the family. There's a law that police cannot enter church premises while a church service is underway.
And that church service ended a few days ago.
Yes, they ended it because they now say they have received assurances from several Dutch legislatures that the family will not be deported. But of course, that came only after more than 3 months of day and night continuous church services. So they are very happy at the moment.
Okay, so what's the latest? What's brought on this stopping of the church service?
Well, the main reason is that the government agreed to give basically amnesty to hundreds of children whose asylum requests were originally rejected. But after the government almost collapsed over the issue, they reached a compromise, basically saying that the asylum applications of hundreds of children will be reviewed again. And the expectation is that most of them, almost 700 children and their parents, of course, can stay in the Netherlands.
Can you just explain to us why the government almost collapsed over this issue?
The reason is that the liberal VVD party of Prime Minister Mark Rutte was basically wanting to end the children's pardon as it exists now, meaning that if someone really has his or her asylum request rejected, he or she should go. They say we cannot go on any longer with always showing more and more compassion because the Netherlands can only so much do with refugees. Now, the other three parties said that it's also the obligation of the Netherlands to show more tolerance to people in need. They basically agreed on a compromise saying that, all right, for now we will review all those applications and it is expected that at least 90% of the people can stay.
But won't this encourage more people to head for the Netherlands?
That is indeed what the far-right politician Geert Wilders of the PVV party said in parliament.
What a feast for all the illegale, all the migranten die hier een verblijfsvergunning willen.
This government deal means a massive celebration for all illegal migrants who want to have a residence permit here, for all human smugglers, for all the lawyers of foreigners and the asylum industry. They have a great day, as hundreds and possibly much more than 1,000 illegal migrants can stay here.
That's what he says, of course, but at the other hand, there are other people who say that people like him simply don't understand their situation. One of them is actually, it's very interesting, he's a 9-year-old boy from Iraq, Nemer. He posted a video on a social network site Twitter, and this is what he had to say.
The children's pardon is back. I am thanking everybody, the Netherlands, the Dutch Parliament, and everybody who supported me. I didn't do this only for myself, but for hundreds of other children in a similar situation. Hooray, it finally happened.
He is of course very happy and he has really thanked the Dutch parliament and also everybody who supported him. But yeah, it really remains to be seen what will happen after this group can stay in the Netherlands, because of course this issue is not gone. There will be more refugees and more people in similar situations, and of course we have to wait and see whether it will be really as strict as planned now, that this was really the last time, or whether the Netherlands will once again say in a few years, all right, these people can stay as well.
Stefan Bos, thanks for joining us with the very latest on Inside Europe.
You're welcome.
Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. You can listen again or download the podcast at dw.com/Inside Europe. We're also on SoundCloud and iTunes.
Okay, got a question for you. Would you quit eating meat in favour of something more sustainable? How would you feel about eating insects, specifically crickets? Some people say we need to seriously consider the benefits of insects as food. Could it help reduce our meat intake and solve climate change? Kathleen Schuster has this report, and it's going to make you hungry.
Thousands and thousands of crickets. They live in plastic boxes in one of the world's biggest cricket farms, which is situated in the city of Chiang Mai in Thailand. They're growing here to be, one day, gently chilled to sleep. Then, in their hibernation phase, a special machine cleans them and sends them into a grinder to turn them into a kind of powder, or flour, if you like. Their final fate is to end in somebody's, probably European, belly. The farm belongs to two guys from the Czech Republic. They make protein and energy bars with a very specific ingredient, cricket flour. In the center of Prague, where their startup Sense Food is located, co-founder Radek Hushek explains why they want to use insects.
Sometimes people ask me if we consider that we would really put insects on that large scale as we produce beef or pigs or chicken, if it wouldn't be just the same bad industry as it is now. So if we compare it to beef, for 1 kilo of protein, let's say, we need 12 times less feed, and it produces 100 times less greenhouse gases. And this would really stay even if we farm really a lot of crickets. So I always say, no, it will just be better, always.
A friend of Hushek's read about benefits of insects in a publication called Edible Insect: Future Prospect for Food and Feed Security, which was published by the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations in 2013. It highlights, for example, that insects are not just a healthy source of protein, but also require much less water, energy, and land to produce compared to cattle, pigs, or poultry. So Hushek and his friends started to wonder why there aren't products with insects on the shelves already.
And we found out that there are many challenges that we need to tackle as a startup. The first one is quite obvious. For Western people, it's not really common to eat bugs.
They don't say they sell products with crickets because most people would visualize eating the entire bug.
Rather, we call always that we are selling products with cricket flour. The whole communication was to set up in a way how we can overcome this yak factor and focus mainly on the benefits.
Unfortunately, potential consumers being disgusted at the idea wasn't the only obstacle they had to overcome. They had to establish their company in Great Britain and license their product there. In 2016, there weren't any regulations in the EU that allowed insects to be eaten as food. But the situation changed at the beginning of 2018. And even though Hushek and his friend come from the Czech Republic, they were targeting markets in Great Britain and Germany.
We considered that these countries quite sustainably oriented. We've heard about how sustainability is for a lot of people crucial decision maker when they are buying food. At least the younger generation, which we focus at, Germans really showed open to new ideas and able to try insects for the first time.
And they do, even despite the fact that the price of cricket flour and products made from it is still quite high. The price is actually comparable to the cost of dried beef. That's because you need about 1,600 crickets for 100 grams of flour. Therefore, the Czech startup has been trying to reduce the amount needed. But is it worthwhile to pay for food that is healthy, sustainable, and climate-friendly?
I'm careful with saying that it would be beneficial for the climate.
Oliver Schluter is an expert from the Leibniz Institute for Agricultural Engineering.
We know that the amount of land which we have to use for insects is much lower when compared to cattle or pig or poultry or so. But the question of the emission is not fully clarified so far. So there are still some open questions, research questions, which we have to address in future.
He's also skeptical about the benefits of farming insects, such as less water consumption.
There are some data on the water footprint, and it seems that it's quite similar to pork meat and poultry, but much less than for cattle. This is given by a reference by Grau et al. In 2017 in the Journal of Naturforschung. They also compare the global warming potential, and they claim that it's lower for insects compared to the others. But here I think some more data are needed.
In terms of human food, Western countries are just at the beginning of experimenting with insects. According to Schluter, it's also necessary to deal with some challenging questions, such as the ethics of killing insects or the potential health and safety risks during insect farming. However, he believes that insects will soon be on our supermarket shelves.
I would assume that it will play a stronger role and it become a bit more conventional the next years. If it's proof that the impact on the environment is much lower than for other protein sources, or you can show clear benefits when using insects for food and feed, then I'm sure we will see more and more insect products on the market.
He also thinks we might use insects as an alternative.
I would not say that all of us have to eat insects instead of meat, but it might be an interesting additional source of protein. We will see how the consumer, also in Europe, will behave and will support this idea of alternative protein sources.
Plus, trends in gastronomy are still changing. After all, it wasn't that long ago that sushi came to Europe and many Europeans distrusted raw fish from Asia. But nowadays, sushi's gained worldwide fame. So, will the fate of crickets, mealworms, and other bugs be similar? Maybe.
Would you be willing to eat insect or products from insect?
No, I don't want to taste. It's not our culture and it's emotional negative.
I'm honestly not sure. I'm not really informed about insect products, so I can't really have an opinion on that.
I would eat bugs if they're fried. Then I could imagine eating it. Not just like that.
And how do opinions change after actually trying an insect product?
Oh, it's from crickets.
So how does it taste?
Like any standard energy bar, there's no difference at all. And if the price was like for meat, I think that would work.
Okay, then I'll have to try it. Is it disgusting? Okay, let's see. I'm going to take a bite from this. Yeah, I like it. I think the reason why we don't eat it is because we hesitate to eat things we are not used to eat. If you wouldn't have told me, I would say it's really good. I would still say it, but it's just hesitation to actually eat it.
According to Hushek, there have already been campaigns aimed at changing attitudes towards eating bugs.
For example, in Denmark, there is quite a unique situation because there are connected scholar bodies, so universities, businesses, and also government, and they took insects as really their topic. They know that they are facing this food crisis, and they already started working on this. So, for example, I've heard that in just last year, 30 times there were insects in primetime TV time. They communicate the benefits much more often, and then it really goes to the whole spectrum of people.
The Czech startup isn't the only one working on this issue. In Germany, a startup called Instinct sells energy bars made from cricket flour. And like in Denmark, cooperation with scientists helped them to normalize their products. But it's still a huge challenge, as company founder Alexander Pfaff explains.
We already work together with different scientists, but at the moment there are very few scientists interested in the field of insect eating. We have to speak a lot that the people see us and that the people understand that it's not something unconventional to eat insects.
Pfaff and his friend also want to build an insect farm in Germany, but it turned out to be too complicated.
There are EU laws, and the EU laws are very clear. Unfortunately, to work with the laws, there have to be regulations on a more communal basis. So authorities in Berlin, for instance, they have to know how to handle the laws. And the German government didn't make any regulation how the EU law should be handled on a local basis. And so many authorities says, yeah, I don't know, so better don't do it. And that's very restrictive, but there are no restrictions on the insects itself.
So the German startup orders its cricket flour from Canada, which has the only certified organic cricket farm in the world. It doesn't look like insects are going to dominate the European food market anytime soon, but maybe in the distant future they could. And if they do, would you try them?
Definitely food for thought, isn't it? I told you it would make you hungry. Yeah, crickets, eh? That report from Kathleen Schuster, which was compiled by Teresa Stastner. Coming up, that report I promised you about how to persuade children to get more interested in ballet. I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. It usually doesn't take much persuasion to get children to go and see a film at the cinema. It can be quite a different situation, though, for other art forms, like sitting quietly for a ballet performance. Now, a British ballet company has come up with an idea they hope will introduce a new young audience to classical dance, and perhaps their parents as well. Lars Bevanger has this report from Manchester in the UK.
We got sweets there. And popcorn there.
I'm at one of those massive multi-screen cinema complexes where you can pick and choose from a dizzying array of made-for-popcorn blockbusters. There's a group of children aged around 4 to 6 eagerly waiting to get into one of the screens, but they're not here to watch the latest Pixar animation or Mary Poppins.
We're going to watch a ballet.
Yeah. Hello there. I hope you're all sitting comfortably in the cinema. My name is Anita, and before we all get to watch the wonderful ballet, I thought it might be nice if I told you a little story.
This is the story of the tortoise and the hare, performed by world-class dancers from the Leeds-based Northern Ballet Company. Most children will already be familiar with the story, and with the use of bright colours, fun costumes and some animation, the dancers on the silver screen have this audience transfixed.
So, you take a step with that leg and cross it over this leg. Step, another step, and three bobs of the head. Bob, bob.
Hi, my name's Gavin McCaig. I am the tortoise, and I've got a massive, kind of pliable shell on my back that allows me to move, and I've got a little beanie hat on. So basically the cinema screenings, at the beginning of them, we are going to teach the kids some of the dance moves so that during the performance they can kind of get up and have a little dance along with us. It's just great to see kids engaging with the arts in that way.
Gavin McCaig and his fellow dancers have already been touring with 3 different live ballets, especially adapted for children. But now the ballet company hopes to reach a far bigger audience with these filmed versions. With the help of event cinema distributor Cinevents, they'll host over 200 screenings across the UK this winter and spring. David Nixon is the Northern Ballet's artistic director.
Once you put something into a cinema, you have that possibility to really reach out and go further. It's an experiment. I mean, we haven't done it before. We're hoping people engage with it and that they see it as an add-on to theatre experiences, not instead of.
After they've seen something like this in the cinema, is it also your hope that they might then feel it's time to approach the theatre if they haven't already done so?
You're always trying to get people to the theatre. It's about new people, and it's about this kind of unconscious bias that some people have that they can't go to a theatre. I know some people feel that it, you know, when you enter into that elitist thing, I'm not of the right class to go to theatre. And so hopefully, in that different environment, if people see, wow, actually I'm quite enjoying this performance, maybe I'll go see a live performance now. That would really be the icing on the cake, which is always my favourite part.
I wear a straw hat with a lot of flowers around and a very soft dress that covers my belly.
Teresa Saavedra dances as one of the three little pigs in one of the other children's ballets, which are now in UK cinemas. From the live performances she has done earlier, she's convinced ballet is an art form that connects with kids.
Because they are kids, they don't stay quiet and they are always making comments and funny faces and commenting with their friends and their parents. It's great. It's satisfying to see them laugh and make funny comments.
Her co-dancer Filippo De Viglio agrees.
They engage with you in a very different way than adults engage with you in a normal show. The kids cheer all the way through it, so they give you an energy to like keep going and do it for them that it's different. So you just want to give everything for these kids because you're really making their day and they show it to you.
During the screening of The Tortoise and The Hare, some of the children get to their feet and try to follow the dancers on the screen. I catch up with some of them and their parents as they leave the cinema.
I like The Tortoise. Because I liked him because my favourite colour is green and purple.
All right. Which one was your favourite character?
The rabbit that had the blue one in it. Because I liked his dance moves.
You're wearing a ballerina dress today. Was that specially to go and watch the ballet?
Yeah.
As an introduction for young children, it's a great way to do it because it's on a small scale. Because the length is more manageable than a normal feature film. I think it's a really positive thing. She really enjoyed it.
I think it's great. I think anything that makes the arts more accessible is a good thing.
I thought it was a great way to show children that ballet was accessible to different ages and also to boys and girls.
Well, one of the thoughts from the ballet company itself with this is to try to get more people actually to the theatre. Do you think that this could be a gateway to do that?
Yes, it could. I think it needs to be advertised more in schools and things to show people that it's available. But yes, certainly.
There's a more serious note to all of this too, and it's about money. A slowdown in funding for state schools has also hit the arts. In a recent survey, 2/3 of state primary school teachers in England said there was less arts education now than in 2010. Many private schools, which might charge considerable fees from parents, have their own drama departments and theatres. Some fear this could lead to inequality in access to the arts from an early age. Bringing ballet to the masses, like in this cinema performance, could be one way of improving this situation. Lars Bevanger, DW, Manchester.
And that's our show today. The programme is produced with help from Helen Sini. The sound technician is Lena Hiller. And I'm Keith Walker. Thank you for listening. You can also subscribe to the podcast of the show on SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, and your favourite podcast platform. Inside Europe comes to you from Germany's international broadcaster, DW in Bonn.